questionnaire, it would all become real. John would become the informant, and Alice would become the dying, incompetent patient. She wasn't ready to turn herself in. Not yet. "Come on, the gates close in an hour," said John. "Okay," said Alice. "I'm ready." Founded in 1831 as America's first non-sectarian garden cemetery, Mount Auburn was now a National Historic Landmark, a world-renowned arboretum and horticultural landscape, and the final resting place for Alice's sister, mother, and father. This was the first time that her father would be present on the anniversary of that fateful car accident, dead or otherwise, and it irritated her. This had always been a private visit between her and her mother and sister. Now he would be there too. He didn't deserve to be. They walked down U Avenue, an older section of the cemetery. Her eyes and pace lingered as they passed the familiar headstones of the Shelton family. Charles and Elizabeth had buried all three of their children, Susie, just a baby, maybe a stillbirth, in 1866, Walter, aged 2, in 1868, and Carolyn, aged 5, in 1874. Alice dared to imagine Elizabeth's grief by superimposing her own children's names on the gravestones. She could never hold the macabre images for long. Anna, blue and silent at birth, Tom, dead, probably following an illness, in his yellow, feety pajamas, and Lydia, rigid and lifeless after a day of coloring in kindergarten. The circuits of her imagination always rejected this sort of gruesome specificity, and all three of her children animated quickly back to the way they were. Elizabeth was 38 when her last child died. Alice wondered whether she tried to have more children, but could no longer conceive, or whether she and Charles started sleeping in separate beds, too scarred to risk the purchase of another tiny headstone. She wondered whether Elizabeth, who lived 20 years longer than Charles, ever found comfort or peace in her life. They continued in silence to her family's plot. Their gravestones were simple, like granite Brobdingnagian shoeboxes, and stood in a discreet row under the branches of a purple-leaf beech tree. Anne Lydia Daly, 1955 to 1972. Sarah Louise Daly, 1931 to 1972. Peter Lucas Daly, 1932 to 2003. The low-branched beech tree towered at least 100 feet above them and wore beautiful, glossy, deep purplish-green leaves in the spring, summer, and fall. But now, in January, its leafless black branches cast long, distorted shadows on her family's graves, and it looked perfectly creepy. Any horror movie director would love that tree in January. John held her gloved hand as they stood under the tree. Neither of them spoke. In the warmer months, they'd hear the sounds of birds, sprinklers, grounds crew vehicles, and music from car radios. Today the cemetery was silent, but for the distant tide of traffic beyond the gates. What did John think about while they stood there? She never asked him. He had never met her mother or sister, so he'd be hard-pressed to entertain thoughts of them for very long. Did he think about his own mortality or spirituality? About hers? Did he think about his parents and sisters, who were all still alive? Or was he in a different place entirely, going over the details of his research or classes, or fantasizing about dinner? How could she possibly have Alzheimer's disease? Strong genetic linkage. Would her mother have developed this if she had lived to be 50? Or was it her father? When he was younger, he drank obscene volumes of alcohol without ever appearing overtly drunk. He grew increasingly quiet and introverted, but always retained enough communication skills to order the next whiskey, or to insist that he was okay to drive. Like the night he drove the Buick off Route 93 and into a tree, killing his wife and younger daughter. His drinking habits never changed, but his demeanor did, probably about 15 years ago. The nonsensical, belligerent rants, a disgusting lack of hygiene, not knowing who she was. Alice had assumed it was the liquor, finally taking its toll on his pickled liver and marinated mind. Was it possible that he had been living with Alzheimer's disease and was never diagnosed? She didn't need an autopsy. It fit too precisely not to be true, and it provided her with the ideal target to throw her blame. "Well, Dad, are you happy? I've got your lousy DNA. You're going to get to kill us all. How does it feel to murder your entire family?" Her crying, explosive and anguished, would have seemed appropriate to any stranger observing the scene. Her dead parents and sister buried in the ground, the darkening graveyard, the eerie beech tree. To John, it must have come completely unexpected. She hadn't shed a single tear over her father's death last February, and the sorrow and loss she felt for her mother and sister had long been tempered by time. He held her without coaxing her to stop, and without hinting that he'd do anything but hold her for as long as she cried. She realized the cemetery was closing any minute. She realized she was probably worrying John. She realized no amount of crying would cleanse her contaminated brain. She pressed her face harder into his wool peacoat and cried until she was exhausted. He held her head in his hands and kissed the wet outside corner of each of her eyes. "Allie, are you okay?" "I'm not okay, John. I have Alzheimer's disease." She almost thought she'd said the words aloud, but she hadn't. They remained trapped in her head, but not because they were barricaded by plaques and tangles. She just couldn't say them aloud. She pictured her own name on a matching headstone next to Anne's. She'd rather die than lose her mind. She looked up at John, his eyes patient, waiting for an answer. How could she tell him she had Alzheimer's disease? He loved her mind. How could he love her with this? She looked back at Anne's name carved in stone. "I'm just having a really bad day." She'd rather die than tell him. She wanted to kill herself. Impulsive thoughts of suicide came at her with speed and brawn, outmaneuvering and muscling out all other ideas, trapping her in a dark and desperate corner for days. But they lacked stamina and withered into a flimsy flirtation. She didn't want to die yet. She was still a well-respected professor of psychology at Harvard University. She could still read and write and use the bathroom properly. She had time, and she had to tell John. She sat on the couch with a gray blanket on her lap, hugging her knees, feeling like she might throw up. He sat on the edge of the wing chair opposite her, his body utterly still. "Who told you this?" asked John. "Dr. Davis. He's a neurologist at Mass General." "A neurologist? When?"
10 days ago."
He turned his head and spun his wedding band while he seemed to examine the paint on the wall. She held her breath as she waited for him to look at her again. Maybe he'd never look at her the same way. Maybe she'd never breathe again. She hugged herself a little tighter. "He's wrong, Allie."
"He's not."
"There's nothing wrong with you."
"Yes, there is. I've been forgetting things."
"Everyone forgets things. I can never remember where I put my glasses. Should this doctor diagnose me with Alzheimer's too?"
"The kinds of problems I've been having aren't normal. It's not just misplacing glasses."
"All right, so you've been forgetting things, but you're menopausal, you're stressed, and your father's death probably brought back all sorts of feelings around losing your mom and Anne. You're probably depressed."
"I'm not depressed."
"How do you know? Are you a clinician? You should see your own doctor, not this neurologist."
"I did."
"Tell me exactly what she said." She didn't think it was depression or menopause. She didn't really have an explanation. She thought I might not be getting enough sleep. She wanted to wait and see me in a couple of months.
"See, you're just not taking care of yourself."
"She's not a neurologist, John. I get plenty of sleep. And that was in November. It's been a couple of months, and it's not getting any better. It's getting worse." She was asking him to believe in a single conversation what she had denied for months. She started with an example he already knew. "Remember I didn't go to Chicago?" "That could happen to me or anyone we know.
We have insane schedules. We've always had insane schedules, but I've never forgotten to get on a plane. It's not like I just missed my flight. I completely forgot about the conference altogether, and I'd been preparing for it all day. He waited. There were giant secrets he didn't know about. I forget words. I completely forgot the topic of the lecture I was supposed to give and the time it took to walk from my office to class. I can't decipher the intention behind words I write in the morning on my to-do list by the middle of the afternoon. She could read his unconvinced mind. Overtired, stress, anxiety. Normal, normal, normal. I didn't make the pudding on Christmas Eve because I couldn't. I couldn't remember a single step of the recipe. It was just gone, and I've made that dessert from memory every year since I was a kid. She presented a surprisingly solid case against herself. A jury of her peers might have heard enough, but John loved her. I was standing in front of Nini's in Harvard Square and had absolutely no idea how to get home. I couldn't figure out where I was. When was this? September. She broke his silence, but not his determination to defend the integrity of her mental health. That's only some of it. I'm terrified to think about what I'm forgetting that I'm not even aware of. His expression shifted, as if he identified something potentially meaningful in the Rorschach-like smudges on one of his RNA films. Dan's wife. He said it more to himself than to her. What? She asked. Something cracked. She saw it. The possibility of it seeped in, diluting his conviction. I need to do some reading, and then I want to talk to your neurologist. Without looking at her, he got up and went straight into the study, leaving her alone on the couch, hugging her knees, feeling like she needed to throw up. February 2004. Friday. Take your morning medications. Check. Department meeting, 9 o'clock, room 545. Check. Return emails. Check. Teach motivation and emotion class, 1 o'clock, Science Center, Auditorium B, homeostasis and drives lecture. Check. Genetic counselor appointment. John has info. Take your evening medications. Stephanie Aaron was the genetic counselor affiliated with Mass General Hospital's Memory Disorders Unit. She had shoulder-length black hair and arched eyebrows that suggested a curious openness. She greeted them with a warm smile. "So tell me why you're here today," Stephanie said. "My wife was recently told she has Alzheimer's disease, and we want her screened for the APP, PS1, and PS2 mutations." John had done his homework. He'd spent the last several weeks buried in literature on the molecular etiology of Alzheimer's. Errant proteins born from any of these three mutated genes were the known villains for the early onset cases. "Alice, tell me, what are you hoping to learn from the testing?" Stephanie asked. "Well, it seems like a reasonable way to try to confirm my diagnosis. Certainly more so than a brain biopsy or an autopsy." "Are you concerned that your diagnosis might be inaccurate?" "We think it's a real possibility," said John. "Okay, first, let's walk through what a positive versus a negative mutation screen would mean for you. These mutations are fully penetrant. If you're mutation positive for APP, PS1, or PS2, I would say that's a solid confirmation of your diagnosis. Things get a bit tricky, though, if your results come back negative. We can't really interpret with any certainty what that would mean. About 50% of people with early onset Alzheimer's don't show a mutation in any of these three genes. This isn't to say that they don't actually have Alzheimer's or that their disease isn't genetically based. It's just that we don't yet know the gene in which their mutation resides. "Isn't that number more like 10% for someone her age?" asked John. "The numbers are a bit more skewed for someone her age, that's true. But if Alice's screen comes back negative, we unfortunately can't say for sure that she doesn't have the disease. She may just happen to fall in the smaller percent of people that age with Alzheimer's who have a mutation in a gene not yet identified." It was just as plausible. if not more so when coupled with Dr. Davis's medical opinion. Alice knew that John understood this, but his interpretation fit the null hypothesis of, Alice does not have Alzheimer's disease, our lives aren't ruined, whereas Stephanie's did not. Alice, does this all make sense to you? Stephanie asked. Although the context made the question legitimate, Alice resented it and glimpsed the subtext of conversations in her future. Was she competent enough to understand what was being said? Was she too brain-damaged and confused to consent to this? She'd always been addressed with great respect. If her mental prowess became increasingly replaced with mental illness, what would replace that great respect? Pity? Condescension? Embarrassment? Yes, said Alice. I also want to make it clear that if your screening comes back with a positive mutation, a genetic diagnosis isn't going to change anything about your treatment or prognosis. I understand. Good. Let's get some information on your family, then. Alice, are your parents living? No. My mother died in a car accident when she was 41, and my father died last year at 71 of liver failure. How were their memories while they were alive? Did either of them show signs of dementia or personality changes? My mother was perfectly fine. My father was a lifelong alcoholic. He'd always been a calm man, but he got extremely volatile as he got older, and it became impossible to have a coherent conversation with him. I don't think he recognized me at all for the last several years. Was he ever brought in to see a neurologist? No, I had assumed it was the drinking. When would you say these changes began? Around his early 50s. He was blind drunk every day. He died of cirrhosis, not Alzheimer's, said John. Alice and Stephanie paused and silently agreed to let him think what he wanted and move on. Do you have any brothers or sisters? My only sister died in that car accident with my mother when she was 16. I don't have any brothers. How about aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents? Alice relayed her incomplete knowledge of the health and death histories of her grandparents and other relatives. Okay, if you don't have any other questions, a nurse is going to come in and draw a sample of blood. We'll send it off to be sequenced and should have the results within a couple of weeks. Alice stared out the window as they drove down Starro Drive. It was frigid outside, already dark at 5:30, and she didn't see anyone braving the elements along the edges of the Charles. No signs of life. John had the stereo turned off. There was nothing to distract her from thoughts of damaged DNA and necrotic brain tissue. It's going to be negative, Allie. But that wouldn't change anything. It wouldn't mean I don't have it. Not technically, but it creates a whole lot more room for thinking this is something else. Like what? You talked to Dr. Davis. He already tested me for every cause of dementia you could come up with. Look, I think you jumped the gun going to see a neurologist. He looks at your set of symptoms and sees Alzheimer's, but that's what he's trained to see. Doesn't mean he's right. Remember when you hurt your knee last year? If you'd gone to see an orthopedic surgeon, he would have seen a torn ligament or worn cartilage, and he would have wanted to cut you open. He's a surgeon, so he sees surgery as the solution. But you just stopped running for a couple of weeks, you rested it, took ibuprofen, and you were fine. I think you're exhausted and stressed. I think the hormonal changes from menopause are wreaking havoc on your physiology, and I think you're depressed. We can handle all of these, Allie. We just have to address each one. He sounded right. It wasn't likely that someone her age would have Alzheimer's disease. She was menopausal and she was exhausted. And maybe she was depressed. That would explain why she didn't push back on her diagnosis harder, why she didn't fight to the teeth against even the suggestion of this doomed fate. It certainly wasn't characteristic of her. Maybe she was stressed, tired, menopausal, and depressed. Maybe she didn't have Alzheimer's disease. Thursday, 7 o'clock. Take your morning medications. Check. Complete psychonomic review. Check. 11 o'clock. Meeting with Dan, my office. Check. 12 o'clock. Lunch seminar. Room 700. Check. 3 o'clock. Genetic counselor appointment. John has info. 8 o'clock. Take your evening medications. Stephanie was sitting behind her desk when they came in, but this time she didn't smile. Before we talk about your results, is there anything you'd like to review about any of the information we went over last time? She asked. No, said Alice. Do you still want the results? Yes. I'm sorry to tell you, Alice. You're positive for the PS1 mutation. Well, there it was. Absolute proof. Served straight up. No sugar, no salt, no chaser. And it burned all the way down. She could go on a cocktail of estrogen replacement, Xanax, and Prozac, and spend the next 6 months sleeping 12 hours a day at Canyon Ranch, and it wouldn't change a thing. She had Alzheimer's disease. She wanted to look at John, but she couldn't will herself to turn her head. As we talked about, this mutation is autosomal dominant. It's associated with certain development of Alzheimer's, so this result fits with the diagnosis you've already received. What's the lab's false positive rate? What's the name of the lab? Asked John. It's Athena Diagnostics, and they cite a greater than 99% accuracy level of detection for this mutation. John, it's positive, said Alice. She looked at him now. His face, normally angular and determined, appeared slack and unfamiliar to her. I'm sorry, I know you were both searching for a way out of this diagnosis. What does this mean for our children? Asked Alice. Yes, there's a lot to think about there. How old are they? They're all in their 20s. So we wouldn't expect any of them to be symptomatic yet. Each of your children has a 50% chance of inheriting this mutation, which has a 100% chance of causing the disease. Pre-symptomatic genetic testing is possible, but there's a lot to consider. Is this something they'll want to live with knowing? How would it change their lives? What if one of them is positive and one is negative? How will that affect their relationship with each other? Alice, do they even know about your diagnosis? No. You might want to think about telling them soon. I know it's a lot to unload all at once, especially since I know you're both still absorbing it yourselves. But with a progressive illness like this, you can lay out plans to tell them later, but then you may not be able to in the way you originally wanted. Or maybe this is something you're going to leave to John to do. No, we'll tell them, said Alice. Do any of your children have children? Anna and Charlie. Not yet, said Alice. If they're planning to, this might be really important information for them to have. Here's some written information I gathered that you can give them if you want. Also, here's my card and the card of a therapist who's wonderful with talking to families who've gone through genetic screening and diagnosis. Are there any other questions I can answer for you now? No, none that I can think of. I'm sorry I couldn't give you the results you were hoping for. Me too. Neither of them spoke. They got in the car, John paid the garage attendant, and they made their way onto Starro Drive in silence. For the second week in a row, temperatures were well below zero with the wind chill. Runners were forced indoors to either jog on treadmills or simply wait for slightly more habitable weather. Alice hated treadmills. She sat in the passenger seat and waited for John to say something, but he didn't. He cried the whole way home. March 2004. Alice popped open the Monday lid of her plastic Days of the Week pill dispenser and poured the 7 little tablets into her cupped hand. John marched into the kitchen with purpose, but seeing what she held, he spun on his heels and left the room, as if he'd walked in on his mother naked. He refused to watch her take her medications. He could be mid-sentence, mid-conversation, but if she got out her plastic Days of the Week pill dispenser, he left the room. Conversation over. She swallowed the pills with 3 gulps of very hot tea and burned her throat. The experience wasn't exactly pleasant for her either. She sat down at the kitchen table, blew on her tea, and listened to John stomping through the bedroom above her. "What are you looking for?" she yelled.
"Nothing," he hollered.
Probably his glasses. In the month since their visit to the genetic counselor, he'd stopped asking her for help finding his glasses and keys, even though she knew he still struggled to keep track of them. He entered the kitchen with quick, impatient steps.
"Can I help?" she asked.
"No, I'm good." She wondered about the source of this newfound stubborn independence. Was he trying to spare her the mental burden of tracking his own misplaced things? Was he practicing for his future without her? Was he just too embarrassed to ask for help from an Alzheimer's patient? She sipped her tea, engrossed in a painting of an apple and a pear that had been on the wall for at least a decade, and listened to him sift through the mail and papers on the counter behind her. He walked past her into the front hallway. She heard the hall closet door open. She heard the hall closet door shut. She heard the drawers and the hall table open and close.
"You ready?" he called.
She finished her tea and met him in the hallway. He had his coat on, glasses perched on his ruffled hair, and his keys in his hand.
"Yes," said Alice, and she followed him outside.
The beginning of spring in Cambridge was an untrustworthy and ugly liar. There were no buds yet on the trees, no tulips brave or stupid enough to have emerged through the now month-old layer of crusted snow, and no spring peeper audio track playing in the background. The streets remained narrowed by blackened, polluted snowbanks. Any melting that occurred during the relative warmth of midday froze with the plummeting temperatures of late afternoon, turning the paths in Harvard Yard and the sidewalks of the city into treacherous lanes of black ice. The date on the calendar only made everyone feel offended or cheated, aware that it was already spring elsewhere, and there people wore short-sleeved shirts and awoke to the sounds of robins chirping. Here, the cold and misery showed no signs of relenting, and the only birds Alice heard as they walked to campus were crows. John had agreed to walk with her to Harvard every morning. She told him she didn't want to risk getting lost. In truth, she simply wanted that time back with him, to rekindle their former morning tradition. Unfortunately, having deemed the risk of being run over by a car less than that of being injured from slipping on the icy sidewalks, they walked single file in the street, and they didn't talk. Gravel kicked up into her right boot. She debated whether to stop in the road to empty it out or wait until they reached Jerry's. To empty it, she'd have to balance in the road on one foot while exposing the other to the frigid air. She decided to endure the discomfort for the remaining two blocks. Located on Mass Ave about halfway between Porter and Harvard Squares, Jerry's had become a Cambridge institution for the chronically caffeinated long before the invasion of Starbucks. The menu of coffee, tea, pastries, and sandwiches written in chalk capital lettering on the board behind the counter had remained unaltered since Alice's graduate student days. Only the prices next to the items showed signs of recent attention, outlined with chalk dust in the shape of a rectangular school eraser and printed in a penmanship belonging to someone other than the author of the offerings to their left. Alice studied the board, perplexed.
"Good morning, Jess. A coffee and a cinnamon scone, please," said John.
"I'll have the same," said Alice.
"You don't like coffee," said John.
"Yes, I do."
"No, you don't. She'll have a tea with lemon."
"I want a coffee and a scone."
Jess looked to John to see if there would be a return, but the volley was dead.
"Okay, two coffees and two scones," said Jess. Outside, Alice took a sip. It tasted acrid and unpleasant and poorly reflected its delicious smell.
"So how's your coffee?" asked John.
"Wonderful." As they walked to campus, Alice drank the coffee she hated to spite him. She couldn't wait to be alone in her office, where she could throw away what was left of the wretched beverage. Plus, she desperately wanted to empty the gravel out of her boot. Boots off and coffee in the trash, she tackled her inbox first. She opened an email from Anna.
"Hi, Mom. We'd love to go to dinner, but this week is kind of tough with Charlie's trial.
How about next week? What days are good for you and Dad? We're free any night but Thursday and Friday. Anna. She stared down the tauntingly ready, blinking cursor on her computer screen and tried to imagine the words she wanted to use in her reply. The conversion of her thoughts to voice, pen, or computer keys often required conscious effort and calm coaxing. And she held little confidence in the spelling of words she'd long ago been rewarded for her mastery of with gold stars and teacher's praise. The phone rang.
Hi, Mom.
Oh, good. I was just about to return your email.
I didn't send you an email.
Unsure of herself, Alice reread the message on her screen.
I just read it. Charlie has a trial this week.
Mom, this is Lydia.
Oh, what are you doing up so early?
I'm always up now. I wanted to call you and Dad last night, but it was too late your time. I just got an incredible part in a play called The Memory of Water. It's with this phenomenal director, and it's going up for 6 shows in May. I think it's going to be really good, and with this director, it should get a lot of attention. I was hoping maybe you and Dad could come out to see me in it.
Cued by the hanging rise in her inflection and the silence that followed, Alice knew it was her turn to speak, but was still catching up to all that Lydia had just said. Without the aid of the visual cues of the person she talked to, conversations on the phone often baffled her. Words sometimes ran together, abrupt changes in topic were difficult for her to anticipate and follow, and her comprehension suffered. Although writing presented its own set of problems, she could keep them hidden from discovery because she wasn't restricted to real-time responding.
If you don't want to do it, you can just say it, said Lydia.
No, I do, but...
Or you're too busy, whatever, I knew I should have called Dad.
Lydia...
Never mind, I gotta go.
She hung up.
Alice had been about to say that she needed to check with John, that if he could break away from the lab, she'd love to come. If he couldn't go, however, she wouldn't fly across the country without him, and she'd have to make up some excuse. Fearful of getting lost or confused far from home, she'd been avoiding travel. She had declined an offer to speak at Duke University next month and thrown out the registration material for a language conference she'd attended every year since she was a graduate student. She wanted to see Lydia's play, but this time her attendance would be at the mercy of John's availability. She held the phone, thinking about trying to call Lydia back. She hung up, thinking better of it. She closed her unwritten reply to Anna and opened a new email to send to Lydia. She stared at the blinking cursor, her fingers frozen on the keyboard. The battery in her brain was running low today.
Come on, she urged, wishing she could attach a couple of jumper cables to her head and give herself a good strong zap.
She didn't have time for Alzheimer's today. She had emails to return, a grant proposal to write, a class to teach, and a seminar to attend. And at the end of the day, a run. Maybe a run would give her some clarity. Alice tucked a piece of paper with her name, address, and phone number in her sock. Of course, if she became so confused that she didn't know her way home, she might not have the presence of mind to remember that she carried this piece of helpful information on her person. But it was a precaution she took anyway. Running was becoming less and less effective at clearing her thoughts. In fact, these days, she felt more like she was physically chasing down the answers to an interminable stream of runaway questions. And no matter how hard she kicked, she could never catch them.
What should I be doing?
She took her medications, slept for 6 to 7 hours a night, and clung to the normalcy of day-to-day life at Harvard. She felt like a fraud, posing as a Harvard professor without a progressive neurodegenerative disease, working every day as if everything were just fine and would continue that way. There weren't a lot of metrics for performance or day-to-day accountability in the life of a professor. She didn't have books to balance, a certain quota of widgets to make, or written reports to hand in. There was room for error, but how much? Ultimately, her functioning would deteriorate to a level that would be noticed and not tolerated.
She wanted to leave Harvard before then, before the gossip and pity, but had no way of even guessing when that would be. And although the thought of staying on too long terrified her, the thought of leaving Harvard terrified her much, much more. Who was she if she wasn't a Harvard psychology professor? Should she try to spend as much time as possible with John and her children? What would that mean, practically? Sit with Anna while she typed her briefs? Shadow Tom on his rounds? Observe Lydia in acting class? How was she supposed to tell them that they each had a 50% chance of going through this? What if they blamed and hated her like she blamed and hated her father? It was too soon for John to retire. How much time could he realistically take off without killing his own career? How much time did she have? 2 years? 20? Although Alzheimer's tended to progress more quickly in the early onset versus late onset form, people with early onset usually lived with the disease for many years longer, this disease of the mind residing in relatively young and healthy bodies. She could stick around all the way to the brutal end. She'd be unable to feed herself, unable to talk, unable to recognize John and her children. She'd be curled up in the fetal position, and because she'd forget how to swallow, she'd develop pneumonia. And John, Anna, Tom, and Lydia would agree not to treat it with a simple course of antibiotics, riddled with guilt over feeling grateful that something had finally come along that would kill her body. She stopped running, bent over, and threw up the lasagna she'd eaten for lunch. It would be several more weeks before the snow melted enough to wash it away. She knew exactly where she was. She was on her way home, in front of the All Saints Episcopal Church, only a few blocks from her house. She knew exactly where she was, but had never felt more lost in her life. The bells of the church began to chime, to a tune that reminded her of her grandparents' clock. She turned the round, iron knob on the tomato-red door and followed her impulse inside. She was relieved to find no one there, because she hadn't formulated a coherent story as to why she was. Her mother was Jewish, but her father had insisted that she and Anne be raised Catholic. So she went to Mass every Sunday as a child, received communion, went to confession, and was confirmed. But because her mother never participated in any of this, Alice began questioning the validity of these beliefs at a young age. And without a satisfying answer from either her father or the Catholic Church, she never developed a true faith. Light from the street lamps outside streamed in through the Gothic stained glass windows and provided almost enough illumination for her to see the entire church. In each of the stained glass windows, Jesus, clad in robes of red and white, was pictured as a shepherd or a healer performing a miracle. A banner to the right of the altar read, "God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble." She couldn't be in more trouble and wanted so much to ask for help. But she felt like a trespasser, undeserving, unfaithful. Who was she to ask for help from a God she wasn't sure she believed in a church she knew nothing about? She closed her eyes, listened to the calming, ocean-like waves of distant traffic, and tried to open her mind. She couldn't say how long she sat in the velvet-cushioned pew in that cold, darkened church, waiting for an answer. It didn't come. She stayed longer, hoping a priest or parishioner would wander in and ask her why she was there. Now she had her explanation. But no one came. She thought about the business cards she'd been given from Dr. Davis and Stephanie Aaron. Maybe she should talk to the social worker or a therapist. Maybe they could help her. Then, with complete and simple lucidity, the answer came to her. Talk to John. She found herself unarmed for the attack she faced when she walked through the front door. "Where have you been?" asked John. "I went for a run." "You've been running this whole time?" "I also went to church." "Church? I can't take this, Allie. Look, you don't drink coffee and you don't go to church." She smelled the booze on his breath.
Well, I did today.
We were supposed to have dinner with Bob and Sarah. I had to call and cancel, didn't you remember?
Dinner with their friends, Bob and Sarah. It was on her calendar.
I forgot. I have Alzheimer's.
I had absolutely no idea where you were, if you were lost. You have to start carrying your cell phone with you at all times.
I can't bring it with me when I run. I don't have any pockets.
Then duct tape it to your head. I don't care. I'm not going through this every time you forget you're supposed to show up somewhere.
She followed him into the living room. He sat down on the couch, held his drink in his hand, and wouldn't look up at her. The beads of sweat on his forehead matched those on his sweaty glass of scotch. She hesitated, then sat on his lap, hugged him hard around his shoulders, with her hands touching her own elbows, her ear against his, and let it all out.
I'm so sorry I have this. I can't stand the thought of how much worse this is going to get. I can't stand the thought of looking at you someday, this face I love, and not knowing who you are.
She traced the outline of his jaw and chin and the creases of his sorely out-of-practice laugh lines with her hands. She wiped the sweat from his forehead and the tears from his eyes.
I can barely breathe when I think about it, but we have to think about it. I don't know how much longer I have to know you. We need to talk about what's going to happen.
He tipped his glass back, swallowed until there was nothing left, and then sucked a little more from the ice. Then he looked at her with a scared and profound sorrow in his eyes that she'd never seen there before.
I don't know if I can.
April 2004.
As smart as they were, they couldn't cobble together a definitive long-term plan. There were too many unknowns to simply solve for X, the most crucial of those being, how fast will this progress? They'd taken a year's sabbatical together 6 years ago to write From Molecules to Mind, and so they were each a year away from being eligible for taking another. Could she make it that long? So far, they'd decided that she'd finish out the semester, avoid travel whenever possible, and they'd spend the entire summer at the Cape. They could only imagine as far as August. And they agreed to tell no one yet, except for their children. That unavoidable disclosure, the conversation they had agonized over the most, would unfold that very morning over bagels, fruit salad, Mexican frittata, mimosas, and chocolate eggs. They hadn't all been together for Easter in a number of years. Anna sometimes spent that weekend with Charlie's family in Pennsylvania. Lydia had stayed in L.A. the last several years and was somewhere in Europe before that. And John had attended a conference in Boulder a few years back. It had taken some work to persuade Lydia to come home this year. In the middle of rehearsals for her play, she'd claimed she couldn't afford the interruption or the flight, but John had convinced her that she could spare 2 days and paid for her airfare. Anna declined a mimosa and a Bloody Mary and instead washed down the caramel eggs she'd been eating like popcorn with a glass of iced water. But before anyone could harbor suspicions of pregnancy, she launched into the details of her impending intrauterine insemination procedure. We saw a fertility specialist over at the Brigham, and he can't figure it out. My eggs are healthy, and I'm ovulating each month, and Charlie's sperm are fine.
Anna, really, I don't think they want to hear about my sperm, said Charlie.
Well, it's true, and it's so frustrating. I even tried acupuncture and nothing, except my migraines are gone. So at least we know I should be able to get pregnant. I start FSH injections on Tuesday, and next week I inject myself with something that will release my eggs, and then they'll inseminate me with Charlie's sperm.
Anna, said Charlie.
Well, they will, and so hopefully I'll be pregnant next week.
Alice forced a supportive smile, caging her dread behind her clenched teeth.
The symptoms of Alzheimer's disease didn't manifest until after the reproductive years, after the deformed gene had unwittingly been passed on to the next generation. What if she'd known that she carried this gene, this fate, in every cell of her body? Would she have conceived these children, or taken precautions to prevent them?
would she have been willing to risk the random role of meiosis? Her amber eyes, John's aquiline nose, and her presenilin one? Of course, now she couldn't imagine her life without them. But before she had children, before the experience of that primal and previously inconceivable kind of love that came with them, would she have decided it would be better for everyone not to? Would Anna? Tom walked in, with apologies for being late and without his new girlfriend. It was just as well. Today should be just the family. And Alice couldn't remember her name. He made a beeline for the dining room, likely worried that he'd missed out on the food, then returned to the living room with a grin on his face and a plate heaping with some of everything. He sat on the couch next to Lydia, who had her script in her hand and her eyes closed, silently mouthing her lines. They were all there. It was time. "Your dad and I have something important we need to talk to you about, and we wanted to wait until we had all three of you together." She looked to John. He nodded and squeezed her hand. "I've been experiencing some difficulties with my memory for some time now, and in January, I was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease." The clock on the fireplace mantel ticked loudly, like someone had turned up its volume, the way it sounded when no one else was in the house. Tom sat frozen with a fork full of frittata midway between his plate and mouth. She should have waited until he'd finished eating his brunch. "Are they sure it's Alzheimer's? Did you get a second opinion?" he asked. "She had genetic screening. She has the presenilin 1 mutation," said John. "Is it autosomal dominant?" asked Tom. "Yes." He said more to Tom, but only with his eyes. "What does that mean? Dad, what did you just tell him?" Anna asked. "It means we have a 50% chance of getting Alzheimer's disease," said Tom. "What about my baby?" "You're not even pregnant," said Lydia. "Anna, if you have the mutation, it's the same for your children. Each child you have would have a 50% chance of inheriting it, too," said Alice. "So what do we do? Do we go get tested?" asked Anna. "You can," said Alice. "Oh my God, what if I have it? And then my baby could have it," said Anna. "There'll probably be a cure by the time any of our kids would need it," said Tom. "But not in time for us, is that what you're saying? So my kids will be fine, but I'll be a mindless zombie?" "Anna, that's enough," John snapped. His jaw clenched and his face flushed. A decade ago, he would have sent Anna to her room. Instead, he gave Alice's hand a hard squeeze and jiggled his leg. In so many ways, he'd become powerless. "Sorry," said Anna. "It's very likely that there'll be a preventative treatment by the time you're my age. That's one of the reasons to know if you have the mutation. If you do, you might be able to go on a medication well before you're symptomatic, and hopefully you never will be," said Alice. "Mom, what kind of treatment do they have now, for you?" asked Lydia. "Well, they have me on antioxidant vitamins and aspirin, a statin, and 2 neurotransmitter drugs." "Are those going to keep the Alzheimer's from getting any worse?" asked Lydia. "Maybe, for a little while. They don't really know for sure." "What about what's in clinical trials?" asked Tom. "I'm looking into that now," said John. John had begun talking to clinicians and scientists in Boston who researched the molecular etiology of Alzheimer's, getting their perspectives on the relative promise of the therapies in the clinical pipeline. John was a cancer cell biologist, not a neuroscientist, but it wasn't a huge leap for him to understand the cast of molecular criminals run amok in another system. They all spoke the same language. Receptor binding, phosphorylation, transcriptional regulation, clathrin-coated pits, secretases. Like owning a membership card to the most exclusive club, being from Harvard gave him instant credibility with and access to the most respected thought leaders in Boston's Alzheimer's research community. If a better treatment existed or might exist soon, John would find it for her. "But Mom, you seem perfectly fine. You must have caught this really early on. I wouldn't even know anything was wrong," said Tom. "I knew," said Lydia. not that she had Alzheimer's, but that something was wrong.
How? Asked Anna.
Like sometimes she doesn't make any sense on the phone, and she repeats herself a lot. Or she doesn't remember something I said 5 minutes ago. And she didn't remember how to make the pudding at Christmas.
How long have you noticed this? Asked John.
At least a year now.
Alice couldn't trace it quite that far back herself, but she believed her. And she sensed John's humiliation.
I have to know if I have this. I want to get tested. Don't you guys want to get tested? Asked Anna.
I think living with the anxiety of not knowing would be worse for me than knowing, even if I have it, said Tom.
Lydia closed her eyes. Everyone waited. Alice entertained the absurd idea that she had either resumed memorizing her lines or fallen asleep. After an uncomfortable silence, she opened her eyes and took her turn.
I don't want to know.
Lydia always did things differently. It was oddly quiet in William James Hall. The usual chatter of students in the hallways, asking, arguing, joking, complaining, bragging, flirting, was missing. Spring reading period typically precipitated the sudden sequestering of students from the campus at large into dormitory rooms and library cubicles, but that didn't begin for another week. Many of the cognitive psychology students were scheduled to spend an entire day observing functional MRI studies in Charlestown. Maybe that was today. Whatever the reason, Alice relished the opportunity to get a lot of work done without interruption. She had opted not to stop at Jerry's for tea on the way to her office and wished now that she had. She could use the caffeine. She read through the articles in the Current Linguistics Journal. She put together this year's version of the final exam for her motivation and emotion class, and she answered all previously neglected emails. All without the phone ringing or a knock on the door. She was home before she realized that she'd forgotten to go to Jerry's. She still wanted that tea. She walked into the kitchen and put the kettle on the stove. The microwave clock read 4:22 a.m. She looked out the window. She saw darkness and her reflection in the glass. She was wearing her nightgown.
Hi, Mom. The IUI didn't work. I'm not pregnant. I'm not as upset as I thought I'd be, and Charlie seems almost relieved. Let's hope my other test comes back negative as well. Our appointment for that is tomorrow. Tom and I will come over after and let you and Dad know the results. Love, Anna.
The odds of them both being negative for the mutation descended from unlikely to remote when they still weren't home an hour after Alice had anticipated their arrival. If they were both negative, it would have been a quick appointment. You're both fine, thank you very much, an out-the-door appointment. Maybe Stephanie was just running late today. Maybe Anna and Tom had sat in the waiting room much longer than Alice had allowed for in her mind. The odds crashed from remote to infinitesimal when they finally walked through the front door. If they were both negative, they would have just blurted it out, or it would have sprung wild and jubilant from their facial expressions. Instead, they muscled what they knew beneath the surface as they moved into the living room, stretching out the time of life before this happened as long as possible, the time before they'd have to unleash the hideous information they so obviously held. They sat side by side on the couch, Tom on the left and Anna on the right, like they had in the back seat of the car when they were kids. Tom was a lefty and liked the window, and Anna didn't mind the middle. They sat closer now than they ever did then, and when Tom reached over and held her hand, she didn't shriek, "Mom, Tommy's touching me."
"I don't have the mutation," said Tom.
"But I do," said Anna. After Tom was born, Alice remembered feeling so blessed that she had the ideal, one of each. It took 26 years for that blessing to deform into a curse. Alice's facade of stoic parental strength crumbled, and she started to cry.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"It's going to be okay, Mom. Like you said, they're going to find a preventative treatment," said Anna. When Alice thought about it later, the irony was striking. Outwardly, at least, Anna appeared to be the strongest. She did most of the consoling. And yet it didn't surprise her. Anna was the child who most mirrored their mother. She had Alice's hair, coloring, and temperament, and her mother's presenilin one. I'm going to go ahead with the in vitro. I already talked with my doctor, and they're going to do a pre-implantation genetic diagnosis on the embryos. They're going to test a single cell from each of the embryos for the mutation and only implant ones that are mutation-free. So we'll know for sure that my kids won't ever get this. It was a solid piece of good news. But while everyone else continued to savor it, the taste turned slightly bitter for Alice. Despite her self-reproach, she envied Anna, that she could do what Alice couldn't, keep her children safe from harm. Anna would never have to sit opposite her daughter, her firstborn, and watch her struggle to comprehend the news that she would someday develop Alzheimer's. She wished that these kinds of advances in reproductive medicine had been available to her, but then the embryo that had developed into Anna would have been discarded. According to Stephanie Aaron, Tom was okay, but he didn't look it. He looked pale, shaken, fragile. Alice had imagined that a negative result for any of them would be a relief, clean and simple. But they were a family, yoked by history and DNA and love. Anna was his older sister. She'd taught him how to snap and blow gum bubbles, and she always gave him her Halloween candy. "Who's going to tell Lydia?" asked Tom. "I will," said Anna. May 2004. Alice first thought of peeking inside the week after she was diagnosed, but she didn't. Fortune cookies, horoscopes, tarot cards, and assisted living homes couldn't tempt her interest. Although closer to it every day, she was in no hurry to glimpse her future. Nothing in particular happened that morning to fuel her curiosity or the courage to go have a look inside the Mount Auburn Manor Nursing Center. But today she did. The lobby did nothing to intimidate her. An ocean-scene watercolor hung on the wall, a faded oriental carpet lay on the floor, and a woman with heavily made-up eyes and short, licorice black hair sat behind a desk angled toward the front door. The lobby could almost be mistaken for that of a hotel, but the slight medicinal smell and the lack of luggage, concierge, and general coming and going weren't right. The people staying here were residents, not guests. "Can I help you?" the woman asked. "Yes. Do you care for Alzheimer's patients here?" "Yes, we have a unit specifically dedicated to patients with Alzheimer's. Would you like to have a look at it?" "Yes." She followed the woman to the elevators. "Are you looking for a parent?" "I am," Alice lied. They waited. Like most of the people they ferried, the elevators were old and slow to respond. "That's a lovely necklace," said the woman. "Thank you." Alice placed her fingers on the top of her sternum and rubbed the blue paste stones on the wings of her mother's Art Nouveau butterfly necklace. Her mother used to wear it only on her anniversary and to weddings, and like her, Alice had reserved it exclusively for special occasions. But there weren't any formal affairs on her calendar, and she loved that necklace, so she'd tried it on one day last month while wearing a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. It had looked perfect. Plus, she liked being reminded of butterflies. She remembered being 6 or 7 and crying over the fates of the butterflies in her yard after learning that they lived for only a few days. Her mother had comforted her and told her not to be sad for the butterflies, that just because their lives were short didn't mean they were tragic. Watching them flying in the warm sun among the daisies in their garden, her mother had said to her, "See? They have a beautiful life." Alice liked remembering that. They exited onto the third floor and walked down a long, carpeted hallway through a set of unmarked double doors and stopped. The woman gestured back to the doors as they shut automatically behind them. "The Alzheimer's Special Care Unit is locked, meaning you can't go beyond these doors without knowing the code." Alice looked at the keypad on the wall next to the door. The numbers were arranged individually upside down and ordered backward from right to left.
Why are the numbers like that?
Oh, that's to prevent the residents from learning.